Coming up on today's show.
When I got to New York City, Henry met me at the train station, and we were walking to his apartment. And we turned a corner, and on the on the sidewalk was the outline of a dead person.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Joining me today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Oklahoma City, my guest is a singer, songwriter, guitar player who was the original guitar player with the Henry Paul Band, the group named for the co-founder of the Outlaws. My guest and the Henry Paul Band opened for the likes of the Rolling Stones, ZZ Top, Peter Frampton, the Allman Brothers, Charlie Daniels, and more. My guest also was the original guitar player for the Byron Berline Band, and present day plays on a new release from Dave Werewolf. He has played with countless artists and at a long line of venues and events, and has met numerous other notable names in music throughout his career. You've been hearing a song by the Henry Paul Band that he wrote called You Really Know What I Mean. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Jim Fish.
Thank you, Bruce. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show.
Let's get started by having you share first all about the song that was just playing called You Really Know What I Mean.
Well, before the album was released and recorded, Great Ghost, we were all writing songs. I remember I went to my little apartment in Sulphur Springs and sat down and just wrote a song for the album. I don't remember what the inspiration was, but I just sat down and wrote the entire song. It has elements of all the music that has influenced me in the years I've been playing. So it's kind of a mixture between Beatles, Birds, and myself. Billboard reviewed the first album and said it was like the Birds meeting the Allman Brothers, which was kind of a good compliment.
Yeah, and how? When you say that you sat down and wrote that, lyrics, melody, or both?
I usually start with a chord pattern and then just something that I like and do some changes that are nifty, and then I'll add words to it at a later time.
So being that that song was by the Henry Paul Band, was that a case of a bunch of you were writing? Did you bring that song to the band and say, what do you think? How did that all go back in those days?
I wouldn't dare say, what do you think? But yeah, that's the process. You know, we all brought contributions and we sifted through them and worked things up on You Really Know What I Mean. Billy and I did a dual guitar outro, which was pretty interesting, and it made the cut, and we recorded it.
Okay. There will be a lot of Jim Fish family, friends, fans, followers who come to this episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. And by the way, to those folks, I say hello, thank you, welcome, and do please check out some other episodes of the show. But over my 11-plus years of doing this show, I have been blessed to get listeners from 166 countries around the world. For the sake of those who are just being introduced to you, Jim, take us back to how you first got started into music, including when did you first start singing, when did you first start songwriting, and when did you first start playing guitar?
Well, it happened to me like it happened to a lot of people in America when the Beatles made their first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. I was about 13 at that time, and Actually, I wasn't really thinking about learning to play guitar, but my older brother, Dean, was very attached to that idea, and he bought a guitar, and he was great at sports, but I was great at music, and I stole his guitar, and I've always been able to pick things out on my own, and that's how I learned. I just basically taught myself and went where my instincts took me. So yeah, I've been playing since 13 years of age. I guess that's about 60 years, which I guess I'm pretty committed to it at this point. But we started with cheapo guitars and little appearances to my brother and I at, for instance, I remember the Albany Association of the Blind. We did some songs, and we did old stuff like Tom Dooley and Johnny Cash and that genre. And I continued playing. I guess it became my ticket to being recognized. Everybody around me in school and my family were really great at sports and went and excelled. I did so poorly in sports, I finally gave up. But I did conquer the guitar in my own way and my identity, and still doing it today. I have a guitar, a 1960 Telecaster, which I found in Temple Terrace at a tiny music store. And it's a real find. I walked in the music store and I looked to my left at a tool bench, and there it sat, a Fender Telecaster that wasn't put together yet. So I went to the owner. I said, "You're going to sell that?" He said, "Yeah." And so I came back a few days later with a guitar and traded it in and a very reasonable amount of money. And I got myself a classic 1960 Telecaster, which I've
Wow.
had since 71.
Wow. And audience, Temple Terrace is in the Tampa Bay, Florida area. Were you living in Oklahoma when you were 13 years old and seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show?
No, I've been here, there, and everywhere. I was born in upstate New York, outside of Albany, New York, in a little villa called Slingerland's, which is a quaint little town. And I lived on an acreage with a beautiful farmhouse, and that's where my affinity for animals started exercising itself.
I want to jump in and ask you though, when you said that you first started playing guitar and you took your brother's guitar, had you already been singing? Did the singing, what order did those come in terms of singing, songwriting, and playing guitar? What came first? What came second? What came third?
Singing came first in the form of the school choir. I remember that in grade school, I actually knew how to read music at that point, and I focused a lot, or at least the teacher focused a lot on harmony. And I guess I absorbed quite a bit of that from those classes, and that really paid off in the later years with both the Henry Paul Band and Byron Verlaine Band. I'm the guy that sings the high parts. Everybody laughs at me, but I can always hit those notes, and I am unafraid to warble if I have to. And I've done a lot of arranging as far as both Byron Berline Band and Henry Paul Band in the way of the vocal harmonies.
Well, I have to ask you, when you said that you taught yourself to play guitar, that was back at a time when there was no such thing as YouTube, there was no such thing as the internet. So, how did you get to a point where you knew that what you were doing correctly? Did you eventually go to a guitar teacher? How did you get anything above and beyond sorting it out yourself?
I've never gotten above and beyond sorting it out
Wow.
myself.
Wow.
I'm self-taught from stem to stern. I have learned a lot from other talented musicians, including Billy Crane, who was the other guitar player in the Henry Paul Band, because I'm always open to new ideas and to continuing to learn. Even to this day, I'll sit and get kind of zoned out and just play stuff that I don't know what it's going to sound like, and come up with some new things that are interesting. But at any rate, my brother did it kind of traditionally. He had a guitar, and he had one of those guitar books, and one of the pages was all the guitar chords. So I just started learning all the chords and putting them together, and I took it from there.
Wow. So while we're talking about guitars, You have played everything from a Chet Atkins Epiphone acoustic electric guitar to a Telecaster to a Rickenbacker 12-string 370 model. Tell us about your approach to tone and playing style. How do you approach your guitar tone in the studio versus live performance? Do you prefer certain types of equipment or setups, and why?
With regards to my Telecaster and my electric playing, I play Fender amps, and they vary in their usefulness, but generally, you know, a Blues Junior is nice. Pro Junior is incredible. It's a tiny amp with one speaker, and it has a volume knob and a tone knob, and that's it. Very basic, kind of like me. I mean, the more complicated it gets, the worse I like it. So my Telecaster sounds, the genesis of it is the Fender amp. And for a long time, I never used a pick, and at this point, I don't use one again. Hmm. But it's kind of difficult to describe. But there are other people that don't use a pick. For instance, Tommy Caldwell, I believe his name is, and Marshall Tucker, and the guy from Dire Straits.
Mark Knopfler.
Yes. Neither one of those dudes use a pick. I don't either. Oh, and I'm left-handed.
Hmm.
So I think I would have picked up the guitar the wrong way instinctively, but in fourth grade, I took violin, which I was terrible at. But I initially put the bow in my left hand, and the maestro said, no, 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 play it like this. So I think it damaged my brain, and I became a right-handed player when I picked up the guitar.
Mm. Wow. Wow.
I think part of my style, which is kind of adventurous and quirky, is because I'm playing right-handed. My right hand is pretty dexterous, and my left is out there doing the thinking. So, yeah, I think it's contributed to my kind of quirky and sometimes unique guitar playing style.
I like that expression. My left hand is out there doing the thinking. That's great. That's good.
Somebody's got to do it.
Folks, this episode is being released less than a week after my having returned from Miami Beach, where I was a speaker and my PR agency had a booth at the B2B Marketing Expo / The Business Show. As I revealed on last week's episode of the show, there is yet another road trip coming up for another speaking engagement I will be doing. Specifically, June 5 and 6, I will be in Quincy, Illinois, for the Indies United Publishing House's Authors Retreat. If you or someone you know are or will be in the area, please get in touch so we can meet. I'm always anxious to meet listeners of this show so that I can say a personal thank you for listening to Now Hear This Entertainment. And keep listening to the show and following on Instagram and reading the weekly e-newsletter for other dates, other events, where hopefully we can meet in person. Jim, I mentioned in the intro that you were the original guitar player for the Byron Berline Band. How did that come to be? Meaning, how did you get that opportunity?
Well, to go back to the beginning, before the Byron Berline Band was developed, a friend of mine in the music scene in Oklahoma came up to me one day and he said, guess who's moving to Guthrie? I lived in Guthrie, Oklahoma. Guess who's moving to Guthrie, he said. And I immediately, for reasons unknown, flashed on Byron Berline. I didn't know he had a Guthrie connection. His wife is from Guthrie, Oklahoma. And not only did I think of him, but I was sure in the knowledge that I would play with him.
Wow.
Just from initially hearing that. So when I found out he was casting around for people to, quote unquote, jam with, I called him, and he said, come on up to the store and play. So by the time I got myself together to go to the store, he had gone home.
Hmm.
So I found out where he lived. It was around the corner from the Double Stop Music Hall, a grand old building in Victorian Guthrie. Anyway, I went to his house, got my guitar out, and I played every song that I could think of that he had appeared on from Country Gazette. I knew a lot of their songs. Of course, I knew the Birds tunes and Flying Burrito Brothers. And we just sat there for about a half hour. And at that time, I was not using a pick, but for bluegrass music, you know, flat picking requires a pick. So I went home immediately after playing with him because I realized I need to learn how to pick. That's when I started in bluegrass with Byron. But he just kind of casually mentioned, we're going to get together Wednesday, me and John Hickman. I've got a bass player and a drummer. Would you like to come? And I said, yes, I would. And that Wednesday evening basically became the Byron Berline Band.
Wow.
But he never said, join this band with me. In the couple or three times that I got back together and played with him after an absence, he never asked me to join the band, but I was in the band. I just, nobody would admit it, I guess.
But tell the audience when this was, because I'm sure there's a lot of young people listening and saying, what is this about? Come and meet me at the store and call me on the telephone. That's not how you audition for a band nowadays. It's not that easy to reach people that they're inviting you to meet them somewhere or just find out their phone number. So what year was that?
I'm thinking 92, maybe.
Hmm.
And one thing I found out about Byron is he loves to play. I mean, he'll pick up a fiddle and a bow for any excuse. He made himself a little music store in Guthrie, and people were in there all the time playing. You know, Byron loved to play more than anybody I've ever known.
When you were playing and you said that you went home and said, okay, well, if we're going to play bluegrass, I got to learn to play with a pick. Did you know while you were playing, oh boy, I blew it. I really should have been using a pick. And if so, did that affect you mentally, or were you able to just kind of, oh well, can't do anything about it now?
Well, I felt like I could do something about it now, and that's why I started using the pick. But I never felt discouraged, like I wasn't making good enough progress, because I had used a pick in various incarnations, but the style of music really requires, for instance, when you're given a solo in a song, boom, 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 you know, you've got to be able to, you know, rat-a-tat it out and keep with the tempo. And that's one thing that I got from playing with Byron and his band was he loved to play stuff really fast. Mm. So I had to invent ways of keeping up with the tempo by my little tricks and my little pull-offs and my little hammer-ons and everything else.
Wow.
But my big influence for bluegrass music was Clarence White.
We've still got lots more to cover, but let's fast forward to some present-day goings-on. First is, you play on a new release from Sawadee Music, a small independent record label. The artist is Dave Werewolf. Is it one song that you play on, an EP full of songs, a full album? And then also, what is your connection to Sawadee Music?
Okay, well, when I moved to Thailand, and I stayed there for about 2 years, in the city I was in, there were quite a few musicians that weren't Thai. And one person I met who was British was Dave Richardson. And he was just a very gifted singer and songwriter. And I went over to his house, and we recorded that song that you've heard with my string bender sounding. And we had planned on, you know, continuing to play together and do appearances and what have you. However, COVID hit. Mm. And that squashed everything. So just starting the band with him and getting the songs together, and then bang, COVID. So we had to change our plans.
As has happened to so many other guests that we've heard in the show, in the way that COVID forced them to change their plans. Another present-day development with you, unfortunately, Jim, is some health issues and a GoFundMe that is currently in place as a result. If it's not too personal, can you share with us about all of that?
I guess I should start by saying I do a lot of reading. I mean, a lot of reading. And, you know, I researched this, that, and the other. And one day I was just out of the blue, Thailand came into my mind. I don't know why, but I realized, wait a minute, I don't know anything about Thailand. So I decided to research it. And it was so attractive and so neat that I decided, you know, I think I'm going to try to move to Thailand.
Wow.
I love the Buddhist approach to living. And so what I did was I started a two-pronged process. one of Finding Thai musicians and one of Finding Thai people that raised birds. And both of those categories are, I mean, everybody in Thailand plays guitar, and they also, many, many people have birds.
Hmm.
So for me, it was a good fit. And so I gradually made a bunch of friends on Facebook, and I moved to Thailand and started playing. It's a lovely, beautiful place. I never felt at risk anywhere I went, and people are friendly and kind. And so that led to the fact that when I retired, I didn't enroll in Medicare. I couldn't use it in Thailand. It's only for people in the U.S.
Yeah.
So I kind of skipped over that. And then as I've grown older through the years, I finally decided I needed to come back to the U.S. and enroll and start addressing some of the health problems that I'm experiencing due to my age. One being my eyesight, which currently is terrible. I have cataracts and some other internal problems that I needed to address. So I'm doing really well now, and I have a plan for cataract surgery coming up in the next months. But I've always been self-paid until about 3 months ago when I finally did enroll in Medicare. So now I'm covered, but I also have a backlog of self-paying responsibilities that I need to start chopping away at. And so I've asked people for help, and a lot of people have jumped in there and really helped me a lot.
Yeah, do I understand? I think you might have had surgery as 2025 began.
Yes, I did. My prostate, which in men my age, you know, a lot of times it becomes enlarged, and then you can go in and have it reamed out so that it lets things flow better. And so I have had that, and it was highly successful, and I'm very thankful to the doctors that took care of me.
I thought you were going to say it was highly expensive.
Well, it was.
But it's good that it was highly successful.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was incredibly expensive, but most of it was picked up by my now healthcare coverage. So, yeah, but that still leaves me with a deductible and all the rest of the stuff I racked up in the past.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. I am joined today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Oklahoma City by singer, songwriter, guitar player Jim Fish. While yes, he is on Facebook and Instagram, on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net, I'm going to put a link to the GoFundMe that you just heard Jim talking about so you can read the information on there and consider giving him some support relative to the mounting medical costs that he unfortunately is facing. You heard me mentioning earlier about having just spoken in Miami Beach and the fact that I will be speaking next month in Quincy, Illinois. If you or someone you know are involved with an event where I can participate as a speaker, I would be grateful for the opportunity to have that conversation. I have spoken all around the country at events ranging from songwriters festivals to podcasting events to author conferences. There is an entire website devoted to all the speaking that I do, with a video, a list of events and places where I've been, and of course the ability to get in touch with me. Go to speakerbrucew.com to see all of that, and then start the conversation towards bringing me to the event that you or someone you know is planning. Jim, we cannot go any farther without talking about the Henry Paul Band. Share with us about that portion of your music career, including, my gosh, some of these great highlights, opening for the Rolling Stones, ZZ Top, Peter Frampton, the Allman Brothers, Charlie Daniels, the list goes on. How did you get that opportunity to begin with?
Well, my brother had a friend kind of close to where we lived, and his name was Frank McCare. And he decided to go to New York City and make it big, quote unquote. And so while he was there, he met Henry Paul. And Henry mentioned to him that he was looking for a lead guitar player and singer to help him start a band. And so Frank gave Henry my number, and Henry called me out of the blue and asked me to come down to New York City where he was staying and play some music, which, as a sheltered country boy, this was a big step for me. And one story I tell just about every time. When I got to New York City, Henry met me at the train station, and we were walking to his apartment. And we turned a corner, and on the on the sidewalk was the outline of a dead person. And we found out that he was killed by a table. Somebody threw a table out of a third-story window and knocked this guy into the next world. And that was kind of an illustration for me of how dangerous it could be in New York City. Being from Slingerlands, you know, surrounded by woods and animals, dogs and cats and what have you, I really was not equipped for city life, but I toughed it out. And we had our one meal a day of ragu, and we played all the time and kept the neighbors going crazy with our foot stomping. But yeah, Henry and I worked on a whole bunch of tunes, and we decided to call the band's name Sienna. It was kind of an odd band. Monty Yoho, who was one of the original Outlaws, played with us when we went down to Tampa. We bought a school bus and put all our stuff on there and drove from New York City to Tampa,
wow,
where we had some gigs lined up. And Monty was in the band. After a certain period, Frank O'Keefe, who was also an original outlaw, joined the band. So we had their rhythm section. Of course, Henry, one of the songwriters and singers. And so it was kind of a precursor of the Outlaws, who became very successful. But Henry and I, we were wearing the same outfit when he came to the train station. You know, kind of a country rock standard outfit of denim shirt and jeans and black cowboy boots. So that was kind of funny when we first met. I know how to back an artist and make them sound good.
Mm.
And that was kind of my role in Sienna. And I sang a few songs too, but I've always loved that position where you're enhancing the music kind of in the background and not responsible for saying to the crowd, "How you all doing?" And the rest of the phrases that come out. But that's been my approach to playing with people, trying to bless them with a good sound, I guess.
I take it from that story that you ended up having to move to New York City, yes?
I did. I lived in New York City for 3 months.
Oh.
And then from there, we went down with our school bus to Tampa and led kind of a communal lifestyle at a couple of various musical practice places and sleeping on the floor or, you know, wherever you could. It was pretty rigorous at times, but, you know, that band was pretty unique and kind of good. And a lot of the songs that we practiced and played in our initial Sienna incarnation were songs that went on to be done by the Outlaws. For instance, we did the song Knoxville Girl, and generally I helped arrange things and, you know, with intros and outros, and of course I sang harmony on basically everything. Another one we did was Girl from Ohio, which came on the second album, and another we did was Freeborn Man, which I introduced to Henry because I loved the song. It was a Freddie Weller tune that I had heard. I bought everything that Clarence White was on, and it had such a unique picking pattern and was such a great song. We started doing it with Sienna, and we arranged it and everything, and I was kind of surprised when I heard the second album and Freeborn Man was on it, and it basically took the arrangement that we had initially made in Sienna. So it was interesting to be on the outside watching the success, and it was a little devastating at times, but like anything, you know, you experience it, you go through it, you learn from it, and you continue
right.
on.
That's right. We do have to move on, but before we break away from the Henry Paul Band, there's too long of a list. I'm only going to ask, you opened for the Rolling Stones? My gosh.
Yeah, I think that was our first gig.
Wow.
We were on Atlantic Records, and one of the muckety-mucks at Atlantic decided to get us a beer on the Rolling Stones tour. So their opening night was in Lakeland, Florida, and we opened for them. we were a little trepidatious because when people go to a Rolling Stones concert, they don't necessarily want to hear the opening band, but we were able to hold our own, and we got a good response. And Henry would tell so many stories about meeting this person or that person, and so I kind of had it in the back of my mind that we would be meeting the Rolling Stones in their dressing room. However, the closest I got to them was from a large parking lot space. They had their whole half of the backstage area way over there, and we were way over here. I could see them, but there was no way to communicate with them.
What year might that have been?
78 or 79.
Okay. And audience, if you didn't hear my interview approximately 5 months ago, it actually came out on Christmas Day with Mark Farner. He is one of the founding members of the legendary band Grand Funk Railroad. Go back and listen to that interview. I will put a link on the show page for Jim's episode on my podcast website, nhte.net, to episode 567. Mark told a really funny story during that interview about Grand Funk Railroad and Janis Joplin being on a show together and a prank that they played on Mick Jagger. So you'll enjoy that one. Jim, you have worked with a ton of artists, Christian Parker, Zach Bowman, Mark Caskey, Tyler Greenfield, just to name a few. Can you tell us about one or two of those collaborations, any standout moments that resonate with you, or perhaps an artist you've not worked with yet but are hoping to collaborate with in the future?
Through the Byron Berline Band and my love of the Byrds, I basically convinced Byron to do a tribute album to the songs of Gene Clark and Gram Parsons. And so we did an entire album with just tunes centered around their writing. And because Byron knows everybody, or knew everybody, we were able to get Vince Gill, Chris Hillman of the Byrds, Al Perkins of so many different bands, and various others, J.D. Manis, the steel player for Desert Rose Band. And we recorded with all these luminaries, and it was really fun, all great guys, and really enjoyed that. So I had this CD backlog of Byrds tunes, and I discovered Christian Parker was doing, you know, tribute albums to the Byrds. So I contacted him and just kind of started a conversation, and I told him about the tribute album. I said, let me try to send you some because I think you'd really enjoy them. So I sent him in various pieces the entire CD, and he was gobsmacked. He said, you've been holding out on me. And it's just getting recognition from somebody who has similar taste in music and loves the Byrds was quite significant for me. And he loved the album, and that led to he and I working on one specific tune, which is Catch the Wind. We had talked about some things we might want to record together. He did the main vocal and a guitar and sent it to me where I lived then in Pittsburgh. And I added two guitars and two vocal parts above his. And that was really thrilling to hear that come together. And speaking of Tyler Greenfield, a good friend of mine, he's a musician in Pittsburgh, and he went to the recording sessions that I did there. He's really a very supportive friend and my best friend in Pittsburgh, which he and I have very similar musical backgrounds and musical tastes. So he plays a Telecaster as well as I do. And we got together, and I was staying over at his house for a while. And, you know, at my age, I'm not going to be here for maybe 30 years more, but I want to pass along some of the things that I've learned and developed. And so he and I, we decided we should call ourselves the Telly Twins. And he benefited quite a bit from my mentorship, and I benefited from his support in finding recording places and working. He's a great guy.
Very nice. Very nice. There's something that you talked about in the first half of the show that, shame on me, I'm only now coming back around to ask a follow-up question, but you talked about living in Thailand. I wonder if your having been there influenced your music, influenced your worldview, influenced your personal life. And then also, did you have any memorable cultural experiences while there that stuck with you?
Yes, to all of those. One thing that I made note of is that music is the universal language. So many people in Thailand, here's the deal. They'll do a picnic or a party, and then the guitars come out, and for hours we're singing and playing.
Wow.
Nothing surprised me more than the number one hit in Thailand around the campfire is Country Roads.
Wow.
They all know the lyrics and sing it in broken English, and it's just amazing to see how people gravitate to some of that stuff. That also a big hit is Hotel California, which I know how to play, but it's impossible for me to sing. It's just too high in pitch. But that's another classic for the Thailand group. And yes, I had many deep experiences spiritually speaking. A friend of mine, his family lives in Surin, which is northeast of Bangkok. And I went with him to family gathering. And one thing that really charmed me was the neighbors came over with pieces of yarn. And they would rub the yarn along your wrist and then tie it around your wrist. And it was either white or bright orange or various other colors, but it's kind of a physical manifestation of a prayer and a blessing. And I was always thrilled to get the strings, you know. In fact, I left them on for months until I got back to the U.S. for a visit, and then I finally thought, well, I better take these stupid things off because people are going to wonder what I'm trying to accomplish. But yeah, it's a wonderful spiritual place, and the people live their Buddhism, kindness to all living things, and it's really a great place to visit.
Was there anything that you took away musically that's native to Thailand? I'm thinking of way back when the show first started. I was maybe a year in, and I interviewed Roger Yeager, and he talked about having lived in India and the fact that as a result, he plays the sitar. Was there anything from Thailand that you took away musically that's native to them, and maybe you applied it in some way to what you do?
Yes. The region that my friend's family lived in is called Isan. And Isan has its own music and its own culture and everything. There were fairs or carnivals held at various monasteries on a regular basis. And you would go into these monasteries, which are supposedly staid and laid back, and there would be raucous Isan music going on, including a very prominent cowbell accompaniment. Tung, 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 tung. And it's so loud that even me as a Southern rocker, I mean, it was, they love that community kind of wow dancing. And so I was gifted a three-stringed Thai instrument that has a different scale. So you know, you get playing on it, and it's, the scale is different. And so you kind of gravitate towards these patterns that are Isan in their genesis. I learned how to play that thing. And, you know, it's kind of akin to bluegrass music with the picking and the fast pace and people's enjoyment of it. So I unfortunately had to leave that three-string instrument in Thailand, but I hope that I'll be able to return, and when I do, I'll pick up another one. They're really fun.
And audience, you notice I asked Jim if being in Thailand influenced his music, and similarly, Jim, you are an animal lover, having raised miniature donkeys and show chickens, and you even were curator of the birds at the Oklahoma City Zoo. That's an interesting contrast to your music career, yet I can't help but wonder if any of your experiences with animals ever inspire any of your songs.
Oh, yeah. The first songs that I wrote, I was 21, and I thought to myself, I need to start writing songs. So I did. And the first one I wrote was called Fox Hunt, which was about a fox that was out running a bunch of hounds and, you know, the story thereof. It was more or less a Br'er Rabbit kind of a song. But, yeah, my love of animals kind of drifted into my musical tastes, and you know, my favorite band was the Birds. So I mean, so I was into the birds, and I was a curator of birds, and I was playing with Byron. And my dual interest throughout my entire life has been birds and music. So wherever I go, I get involved in both of those situations.
But you said in there at the age of 21, you decided I need to start writing songs. So same question as early in our conversation when I asked you about guitar. Did you just find your way into songwriting, or did you eventually seek out someone to say, hey, I'm trying to write songs, but I need some help with what I'm doing?
I'm too much of an introvert to do that.
Hmm.
And so I taught myself how to write songs just by simply doing them and rearranging them and taking that influence into another area. So yeah, I'm self-taught with regards to writing, and I think inertia set in, and when I saw other people like Henry and various others writing and performing their own tunes, I really felt like, well, I better get started or I'm never going to make it. So the first song I wrote was Fox Hunt. The second one I wrote was called Riverside Summertime, which was kind of a story about sitting next to the Hillsborough River on my initial visit to Florida and hearing snakes drop out of the trees. It was a unique experience.
So does the introvert in you prevent you from co-writing, or have you in fact done enough co-writing over your music career?
I've done a few co-writing. If I feel comfortable with a person, I'll be less inhibited. And that's probably where I've erred in being kind of isolated and not writing with others. But the Henry Paul Band, Henry and I and our bass player, Wally Dentz, wrote Lonely Dreamer and Woodwind, which Henry and I wrote. And basically, if you listen to the song, it's Henry doing the main guitar part and me embellishing it with tasteful things that would fit with it, which kind of goes with my sideman approach to music. But it's a really cool little tune, and a lot of people really love it.
But did you record that live off the floor to where you truly were embellishing as you were recording?
Yes. We recorded at Criteria Studios in Miami with the Albert brothers, Ron and Howard Albert. And they were working also with the Bee Gees, the Beach Boys, and also McGuinn, Clark, and Hillman. So this is where we went to record. And, you know, you'd be getting coffee in the lobby, and the Bee Gees would be standing there. So anyway, it was a great experience. And the way we recorded that song was Henry put down the basic track, and then I came in after and worked on the backing, which it's kind of a tricky tune tempo-wise, but it took a couple of takes, but we eventually got it. It was sandwiched between two songs on that first album, and right after Woodwind ends, Grey Ghost begins with a crash. It was two acoustics on Woodwind, and then, of course, all electric for Grey Ghost.
Gotcha. I cannot have a guest on that has spent as many years in the music business as you have and not ask you to share some advice for anyone listening that is an aspiring performer. Jim, you have toured, you have recorded, you have collaborated, you have been on the same bill as some major music heavyweights. What are one or two big takeaways from all that which could be helpful tips, helpful insights for the young people who are trying to get noticed in a very crowded field?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is just don't give up. Keep playing and find people to play with, and just take every opportunity you can to sit with people and to develop your skills and make contacts. And believe in yourself in the sense that, you know, my hard work is going to pay off. Don't get discouraged. I used to give guitar lessons, and one of the standard things when I sat down with usually older people, they'd say, well, I tried to learn to play guitar, but I couldn't. Which, yes, you could. And so, yeah, just don't lose hope. Keep playing. Play with as many people as you can. And believe in yourself, because if it's meant to be, it'll blossom. And if it's not, then you can always do something else.
I think there's also encouragement in your story, Jim, in that you spent little to no time in this interview talking about Los Angeles, talking about Nashville. you talked about New York for all of maybe a minute. And so I think it gives hope to the young people out there who are feeling the pressure. Well, if I'm going to succeed, I guess I have to move to LA. I guess I have to move to Nashville. I guess I have to move to New York. And I think you would say, no, you don't.
I would say, no, you don't. And of course, it's more true today than ever before, because recording has evolved into something other than New York, Nashville, LA based. Even major artists are just recording their own CDs and selling them at their concerts. It's not like you need a major record label these days. You can do it yourself, which I think is a better approach. And you can get a lot done and get the word out and get your stuff heard from virtually any place in the United States if you reach out and have contacts and work with other people. It's just like with Christian Parker, when we started talking, he's in New York and I think I was in Pennsylvania at that time. I've lived so many places, it's hard to remember. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff that you do. You network and you appreciate their stuff and they hear you and they say, wow, that's great. And you just take it from there. He and I, because of our affinity for the kind of music we loved, we did a version of Donovan's Catch the Wind, which turned out so beautifully. Mm. Like I said, I did two guitars in it, and I did two vocal parts, both above him. And I was thrilled when it was mixed and sent to him, and he said, geez, I really love that. And I was pleased with the outcome, but hearing it echoed back from another professional is a big plus.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Great insights, great advice. We are going to close with a song from the Byron Berline Band, one called Home Run King. Jim, before I let you go and we play that track, share with the audience first all about this one, if you would, please.
Yeah. Basically, after I convinced Byron that we should do a tribute to the Byrds, or at least two of their members, Gene Clark and Gram Parsons, both of whom he knew very well, we started selecting songs. And one song that always struck me as really a cool tune, great words and great arrangement, and Doug Dillard played on it and various others. I think Byron did too. But this was one, a really unique song, kind of different from what you might expect out of Gene Clark. But we decided to record Home Run King, and I think it came out really well. We, especially the chorus, which is, you are either just a newspaper boy or you're either Babe Ruth. And we used to listen to that, our three-part harmony, and we thought it sounded like Earl Scruggs and Lester Flatt's band. You know, it was a very, very bluegrassy approach, and it really enhanced the song a lot. I got to play my Telecaster on that song, and also I did an acoustic solo in the middle of it. And, of course, always loved working with Byron. Even before I met him, he was one of my favorite fiddles, him and Vassar Clemens. I love Byron because he was so precise. His intonation was fabulous, and he was just a picker, just a wonderful player. And he also sang. So it was me, the bass player, Richard Sharp, and Byron, and you'll hear all of us on the song Home Run King.
But you play on this song, you do vocals, and you arranged it too, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I was the one that was the Bird band, so I would bring the Bird's tunes to the band, and we'd work them up and make an arrangement and then record them.
Very
so
nice.
We did the whole album with that approach.
Very nice, very nice. Jim, wonderful to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment. I enjoyed the conversation.
I did too, and thanks for reaching out to me. I'll be talking to you soon, I hope.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Audience, with that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to singer, songwriter, guitar player Jim Fish. As I mentioned before, you will find him on Facebook and Instagram, plus on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. I am going to put a link to the GoFundMe that you heard him talk about, which is currently in place in light of the unfortunate mounting medical bills that he has. please connect with me and the show on social media. At the bottom of nhte.net, you will see tons of logos, tons of links for the likes of Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and X. I would love for you to give a follow on one or more of those and engage with me and this show through your platform of choice. That's going to do it for episode 587. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'll send you out today with a song by the Byron Berline Band. This is the one that Jim just talked about. It's called Home Run King.
Morning cry, yelling, read all about it, here's the truth. You are either just a newspaper boy or you're either Babe Ruth. Now how could we have been put upon this planet, fools enough to think that we could be? First form of civilized evolving from the charismatic. Year-old in the alley throws a hard ball off the wall, that is true. He knows you're either just a newspaper boy or you're either Babe Ruth. Home run king. Explicit rationalize and dream of exactly who we are. While the rock and roll and home run king keep black Madonna sleeping with a star. Now it doesn't matter how much bread you can spend so you can hold the center booth. You are either just a newspaper boy or you're either Babe. You are either just a new